We're so glad you're here with us. We know that since these are box lunches, you couldn't possibly be here for the food. So it must be the company, and that you thought it was going to be a great show.
It's the title of the program.
Isn't this a great title? And of course, what we ask ourselves is, how come we hadn't thought of that already, right? This is like the cutest title.
Maria thought of it just so.
No, I don't take credit for that. But as he said, I'm Maria Breu. I'm at the University of Miami when I'm not in Vegas. And I'm joined by two really great friends who also happen to be rock stars in the world of IBD that need no introduction, but Jessica Allegretti, who is at Brigham and Women's Hospital and head of IBD, but really famous because she was a medical student at the University of Miami.
That is my claim to fame. Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
The very first medical student I worked with when I got to the University of Miami. And I knew then, I really did know then, that she was going to run the world. And then David Rubin, who is the head of GI at the University of Chicago and, of course, has made incredible contributions to our field.
I was not your medical student.
We're, to your dismay.
Ever?
I'm your student. I was not your medical student.
So we have, you know, I see that the audience isn't so big, so there's a little bit of intimacy. And, of course, you have the iPads. Presumably, there's this wider world of people that are watching and that might be sending us questions. We're sitting down, so it automatically means that if we're sitting, that it's going to be informal, because how formal could you be if you're, like, you know, sitting? Especially since Jessica and I can't touch the floor with our feet because we're cut from the same short cloth. All right, so we're going to get started, and these are our learning objectives, which you have. Okay, so what I like about this particular slide is I'll make a couple of points on this slide. One, notice there's this big chunk of a gap between 1998 and 2014 when something new was on the horizon. And what's cool about the way that this slide has been designed is it not just tells you about which agents were added when, but which classes and mechanisms of action, right? If you had come to a lecture, a lunchtime symposium, anytime in between those years, 98 to 2014, I don't know, you were alive? Okay.
I was alive.
You would know that we would be kind of splitting hairs. Like, which anti-TNF is better, which is the dose, you know, how did we modify dosing? That would be kind of what we would be splitting hairs about, right? Now we're on to, we have all these different mechanisms of action. You'll go to multiple lectures about when to use what, you know, how to sequence these different things, and do we understand enough of the biology to talk about these. But clearly what you can see, and what, of course, the theme of the program is going to be is on interleukin 23, that, like, in a sense, the era of anti-TNF where, wow, you hit pay dirt when you started inhibiting TNF, we're on a similar era as with respect to inhibiting interleukin 23. We choose medicines based on a lot of things. This next hour and change is going to be a lot about interleukin 23 with a focus on that. But, of course, we know that we have these different mechanisms of action, and some of the things that go through our brain when we're with individual patients is, how sick is that person? How quickly do we need something to act? Do we have a history where they've just been through a lot of different medications how many patients come to you and say, something always works at the beginning, but then it loses its mojo, and I'm always afraid that I'll have to go on to something else. And I find that fascinating, that there are these phenotypes where people really are kind of repeat offenders. They lose, they become refractory to a mechanism, and their immune system figures out a different way to continue this onslaught of inflammation. We heard a brilliant lecture, of course, this morning by my mentor, Steph Targan, who is really the person who got me into IBD in the first place. And so in a way, that's how Jessica's in a sense a granddaughter of that tribe. That really trying to see, can we do better functional genetics and genomics, and could that edify what choice of therapies we're going to use in different patients. Patients are, of course, always worried about safety, although we list infection first because we're talking to a medical audience. If this was a lay audience, really people are only worried about getting cancer. They're only worried about getting cancer, right? I don't know, again, I'm looking to see you're all chewing, but that... in reality, that's the first question people have, not is there an increased risk of infection? Because the reason that we've done so well in microbiology and in antibiotics that we could not have to worry about that. All right, so we try right now, largely we're making decisions on clinical grounds, I won't sort of put a damper on the lunch and say on insurance grounds, but we're making these decisions not necessarily in the way that we wish that we could make them. And again, to draw on something that Steph said that I can again say to you, but I don't necessarily say to patients, is because oncology is much simpler, and yes, I did say that, it is much simpler. You have a monoclonal population that's proliferated with certain mutations, and these mutations drive proliferation, and if you could find which pathway is that is activated or mutated, you could target that. This isn't at all that simple, right? You gleaned that already from the talks that you've been to at this meeting. So in terms of IBD pathogenesis, again, I alluded to the fact that it's not simple because it's multifactorial, all the events that need to come together in order for an individual to develop what we say, oh, you have IBD, you have Crohn's, you have ulcerative colitis. And one of the big revolutions has to do with the genetics of IBD. Even though initially it wasn't as well invested in as looking for the genetics of type 1 diabetes, for example, there was this revolution that occurred in understanding the complex genetics of IBD and incorporating into that knowledge all this new technology, like the ability to sequence the human genome, right? And once that people started sequencing the human genome or doing chip-based analyses where they can look very quickly at the differences between a person with Crohn's disease and a person that did not have Crohn's disease, one of the earliest hits using these strategies was polymorphisms in the IL-23 receptor. I chose my words carefully. Polymorphism just means that it's an area that we're different, genetically different between people. It's not a mutation. People that have these polymorphisms are normal. We have them in this audience. We're all a composite of all these different polymorphisms. And and with respect to IL-23, which is the subject of our conversation today, polymorphisms in the receptor change the susceptibility to IBD. This slide is featuring those initial observations, which is that some polymorphisms are protective from developing IBD, protective. And actually, we're studying whether or not this is true across all populations, whether people that are of Amerindian, i.e. from Latin America and, the Indians of Latin America, those genes, whether this gene is as relevant in those populations as it is in European populations, or is it relevant in those populations because they've been mixed up with Europeans and on their chromosome, that little piece is coming from Europe and those polymorphisms are coming from Europe. So there's a lot of, I think, richness that we still have to discover about the genetic regulation of IBD in an ancestral contextual way. So I'm building up a story, in case you can't tell, about why IL-23 turned out to be like something that we already had like an imagination that this was going to be important in IBD. The genetics was telling us that, right? That if you had certain things that protect, that these receptors could protect or increase the risk of developing IBD. So why target IL-23? Well, it turns out that IL-23 is very important at mucosal interfaces, right? We are interested in that interface in the gut, right? In the gut. And so IL-23 is an important mechanism that we have to protect us against pathogens and pathogenic. The entire gut immune system is not built around let's develop IBD so people can go to a meeting in Vegas. It's built around the ability to fight off pathogens in the event that the box lunch doesn't turn out to be, all that it was intended to be. No, I'm sure it's absolutely fine. I'm sure it's been radiated and has nothing that's really real in it anyway, so that it's not going to have any pathogens. I'm kidding. So IL-23 has, in a sense, it was an interesting choice because on the one hand, IL-23, we need some of it, right, to be protective. And in particular, we need certain, like, Th17 pathway stuff to protect that mucosal barrier. And we know from the human experiment where people were given an anti-IL-17 antibody to treat Crohn's disease, that in fact placebo in that case did better than the drug, that people actually worsened when they received it. Conversely, if you haven't watched the ads, the non-Crohn's ads or the non-UC ads on television, there are a lot of ads for anti-IL-17 directed therapies for people who have psoriasis and other conditions where it's amazing, where anti-IL-17 turns out to be amazing. So there are these subtle differences between what happens in the gut because of and that interface of having one epithelial cell layer keeping us from the outer world or from that inner world, and say skin and other conditions. This shows it diagrammatically here that in a sense what I'm saying is you need this IL-17 protective effect, but then things could really, like everything, that pendulum, you know, it's got to be that sweet spot, right? That sweet spot of biology where too little is bad and too much is bad. Okay. This shows it in a slightly different way, just to make the point that we start with T cells that are naive, that don't know like what they're going to grow up to be. In the context of the cytokines that are in their and the interaction with other cells, like antigen-presenting cells, they may go on to become these Th17 cells. Actually, I heard an absolutely brilliant talk in the microbiome and health and IBD section, like in the last session. And so this requires actually the presence of bacteria for this to occur. And so these Th17 cells could be like the ones that we need to protect our barrier, to keep the bacteria that are kind of constantly on that surface from, you know, attacking us. On the other hand, if there's interleukin-23, we come back to IL-23, in the environment of that T cell, that cell, instead of just being homeostatic, could go on to develop a lot of the cytokines that you're very familiar with, even in the treatment and the pathogenesis of IBD, like TNF, like interferon gamma, and like IL-17. So this IL-23 and the levels of IL-23 locally turn out to be very important for the development of intestinal inflammation. And so I think this is a really cool video. You can see the epithelial barrier on the top. You can see this is meant to be a dendritic cell. It's busy in the mucosa secreting things like interleukin-23 and IL-1 and TNF. You can follow the color code. It's activating these T cells because, again, in the presence of IL-23, these T cells are now busy making Th17 and making these pro-inflammatory cytokines that are damaging that epithelial barrier, causing apoptosis of cells and IBD. This is actually to corroborate that. This is an older study that looks at something easy to see, which is that you can easily see that IL-23 expression is elevated in patients with active IBD, again, corroborating that this is something being made locally in the gut that has implications for ongoing inflammation. So this is a New England Journal of Medicine review article from a couple of years ago that I think is a really interesting concept. And so there are a lot of immune-mediated diseases, right? And we divide ourselves in the world of medicine into you're a rheumatologist or you're an ophthalmologist, you're a dermatologist, you're a gastroenterologist, and so we're organ system-based. But at an immunological level, because again, in biology, you want to take advantage of things that seem to work, right? If you've got a good system going, you want to apply that system across a variety of things. You can see that if you've now looked at signature cytokines, that then things kind of segregate in a different way. And you can see that Crohn's and ulcerative colitis are driven by interleukin-23, and that there are other things like psoriatic arthritis and all that that also use IL-23 as a pathway. But I want to make an additional point on this slide, which is that you can see that in a sense the final common pathway is TNF-alpha. And I use this as an example of the fact that we got a little bit spoiled in IBD because TNF is so central to so many different processes across immune-mediated diseases that's why it fixed people's arthritis and why it fixed people's, you know, occasional psoriasis or ankylosing spondylitis. We don't have that luxury when we use something that's more targeted. On the flip side, when we use something that's more targeted, we might have the opportunity to have less of a bypass, because once you've inhibited TNF, if you've got IBD occurring in people who are already on an anti-TNF, good levels, you know, we can get into the details, that is a person that is going to be very hard to treat with many of these medications. And that's a recurring Achilles heel in our world, which is that anti-TNF refractory patients are the hardest to treat. One of the early ways, am I talking too much? Do you guys have any? No, you're watching the question.
I have a question for you.
Okay. I knew you would.
I've always thought that TNF was upstream and IL-23 is more downstream. But you sort of made it sound like TNF comes later.
I think it does come later. Because I think that these pathogenic... the source of TNF is multiple, right? Because actually probably, you know, monocytes, macrophages are making goobs and gobs of TNF. There's also probably very important TNF production by T cells. The other thing that is hard for us, and I think is going to be more edified, and probably at some of the basic science talks at this meeting, single cell sequencing of human samples is going to be a big deal. Because in a lot of research takes place in mice. And this is an area where mice are actually sufficiently different from humans that we don't know this. It's not so neat, the buckets of you're only a Th17 cell and you're a Th1 cell, because that's not the way biology works. So this thing, I think single cell sequencing might address that, but I think in certain instances, especially on the T cell side, probably IL-23 is upstream of that.
May I ask one more?
Of course.
Well, so the role of IL-17 and the Th17 cells and the potential pro and anti-inflammatory functions, what about IL-12?
I don't know. IL-12, it's an interesting... he's going to present the data on, you know, like the clinical data used to ustekinumab and, you know, some of the IL-23 inhibitors. IL-12 is very important for granuloma formation, right? Really important for granuloma formation. What's amazing is I will tell you that one of the remarkable things about this class of drugs is how safe it is. So obviously we really don't understand what's going on, because how could you be inhibiting these pathways that you would think you're going to die of some awful infectious death, right? If you're inhibiting both interleukin-12 and interleukin-23. And lo and behold, there's the rate of infections is placebo, including for things that would require a granuloma, right, like the tuberculosis and other things to be formed. So we're obviously missing something. And so why wouldn't it be that ustekinumab shouldn't be better than everything else if you're inhibiting both, or why shouldn't it be unsafe, but it's not? So I don't know that I have an easy answer, but maybe we'll get back to it in the context of the clinical data.
And I was just going to say, from one of our virtual listeners, they want to know from you, Maria, of the preclinical data that you've presented so far, and this may be a little premature because we're going to get to some of this, but what's one of these developments that you think has the most likelihood to change practice?
The most likelihood to change practice. I mean, I haven't said it really, but I think, I'm inspired a little by Steph's words. I think one of the things that's most likely to change practice is having some simple test that we could categorize people and say, yeah, you're an IL-23 person, you're going to respond. My sense is, you know, we're seeing very high levels of efficacy with these drugs. My observation, and I really need for you guys to tell me if I'm crazy, is that with anti-TNF therapy, yes, you could find, and we could say there's a primary non-responder, like two people, right? Most of it is like a dose effect, right? That there's at least some partial benefit, right? Like, you know, some people have a very, you know, very great effect and stuff. But with this mechanism, it's like when it works, it's magical. And when it doesn't work, you might as well have given them placebo. And we don't have as many shades of gray as we did with anti-TNF. This is notwithstanding Jessica can tell you about her work with, you know, ustekinumab dosing, and levels, and sort of her beautiful work, and, you know, you can speak for yourself, that at least if you have a partial effect, yes, you can dose optimize, but if you've got bupkis, you probably, they're not a responder. Like, but remember, these are, you know, we spent a month getting the insurance to approve it. We spent another month getting them scheduled for an IV dose. These are not things that, the person is 6 months or more down the line before we redirect what we're going to do for them, right? You know, by the time we decide on this, you know, like, do they have mucosal healing? So there's this whole waste of money, time, energy, emotion for the patient by not having a better way of choosing whether the person is going to respond or not. So thank you, that virtual person. Okay, so this, back to this. One of the earliest things, you know, we anti-TNF was a little bit, you know, bedside to bench to bedside in that. Who knew it was going to be so amazing, right? When we were doing those initial studies of infliximab in people with, you know, Crohn's disease and ultimately with ulcerative colitis, who knew? And one of the early mechanisms that was described to be an effect of the anti-TNF is that it would, in a sense, starve T cells of TNF and cause apoptosis of these T cells, okay? And so this work from Raja Atreya in Germany has found that if there's IL-23 in the environment, it can then protect these T cells that would otherwise undergo apoptosis and the person would have a great response to anti-TNF. It protects these T cells, it causes these T cells to proliferate, make more of them, and it's a mechanism by which you have resistance to anti-TNF. So I want to make that point that, again, IL-23 is this other link to having this negative impact on the efficacy of anti-TNF if you're that person, if you are that person. And it also sets Jessica up a little bit because she's going to talk to you about rational combination therapies and how do we pick, you know, if we had all the money in the world and all the stuff in the world, what combinations of agents could we be using to treat IBD? So hopefully this is enough of a setup for you to get the next question right. Yay!
Look at that.
Yay. We don't actually get paid for this unless you get the questions right and wrong. Okay.
But let me just push back on this a little bit. Do you think clinically this makes sense? Have you seen patients where you have administered IL-23 and then anti-TNF doesn't work as second line? Does this line up with you? In clinical care,
yeah.
Does this impact how you sequence your therapies?
I don't know if this does. Remember, this could be, for all we know, this is a subset of people. For all we know, this is a subset of people that are not going to respond to this. Again, the related question is, if you've got someone already on an anti-TNF and now it lost its mojo, could you then give them an anti-IL-23 to rescue that phenotype? That has not been answered, and hasn't been answered even in some of the studies that we're going to be showing you. But it's an interesting question. And then do we want to get to that point, or wouldn't we have wanted not even to be in that situation of causing that level of refractoriness?
I liked how you said that. I would say that I recycle TNF after going to a different mechanism.
Yeah.
It would be of great interest to know if you go to IL-23, if that somehow enhances your ability to recycle TNF as a mechanism.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Let's do that before the next Crohn's and Colitis Congress, which I hear is in San Francisco. All right, I'm advancing, but okay, great. I'll let David take it over.
All right, well, let me take you through some of the clinical things. I know that many in this room are clinicians, and you have your own observations. And certainly there's been a race to market of some novel IL-23 inhibitors. And I want to give you the clinical data. I'm not going to show you a safety, but mostly efficacy. But I'll start with a few important points and then give you some general observations for you to keep in mind as I go through these slides. The first one is to acknowledge the distinct targeting of our antibodies. And you're going to learn a little bit more about this from both Maria and Jessica. But let's just remind you that ustekinumab, the first drug available in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis that has as its primary mechanism IL-23 inhibition, is actually an anti-P40 antibody. P40 is a subunit that's shared by not just IL-23 but also IL-12. That's why I asked Marie about that question, because we're not really sure what IL-12 does, nor do we understand fully why inhibition of it may or may not enhance or worsen the general clinical benefit of the therapy. Distinct from anti-P40 would be anti-P19, a different subunit. And you'll note on this cartoon that P19 is unique to IL-23. So you're not actually targeting or hitting or affecting in any known way IL-12. So the therapies that have been developed and are in development for P19 inhibition are IL-23 selective, or at least that's the way we talk about them. Now, there's some general observations that we've made as we think about these therapies, and I want to give those to you up front, and then I'm going to take you through some of the data. The first one is that these therapies and targeting IL-23 works in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. The second, and not fully explored, is the general observation that they may work better in Crohn's than UC, but they work in both situations, no doubt about it. The third, as we've already touched on, is that they seem to be extraordinarily safe. We don't see activation of latent TB across the world experience with ustekinumab, and the subsequent IL-23 drugs backs that up. And in general, we think of these as very safe drugs. My very rudimentary understanding of this, not being an immunologist like Maria, has been more that IL-23 acts where you have inflammation and it's not more ubiquitous and involved in infection surveillance or prevention the way TNF does, and inhibition of TNF leads to infections. So those are some of the things to keep in mind. And I want to then go through some of the general trials and evidence we have with some basic takeaway messages to put things in context. We'll start with ustekinumab. The UNITY trials looked at ustekinumab for the treatment of Crohn's disease, patients who had not responded to conventional therapies and in some situations had already been exposed to biological strategies. Mostly it was anti-TNF, as we see in many of these trials. And you can see the two induction studies there, UNITY 1 and UNITY 2. UNITY 1 were, by definition, patients who had been TNF exposed. That means usually they were either TNF resistant or lost response to TNF. They could have also, though, received TNF and been intolerant to it. That's what exposed means. And UNITY 2, which were predominantly naive patients. They hadn't been exposed to anti-TNF. And of course, in Crohn's, repeatedly we see this theme that when you have been not on other biological therapies, which may be just a marker of shorter disease duration, you do better with whatever therapy you're about to receive. You can also see the immunity study on the right there, which is the maintenance data for ustekinumab. And you can appreciate on the left induction, which was intravenous, weight-based dosing, 6 milligrams per kilogram versus a standard dose of 130 milligrams. And on the right, the 90 milligrams every 8 or every 12 weeks. In many parts of the world, it's offered at either interval in maintenance phase. In the United States, we use the every 8 week, and that's how it was labeled. And in general, that's because, as you can see there, at least numerically, the every 8 week worked better. And if you actually looked at subset analyses, every 8 week especially works better in patients with complex Crohn's or those who've been exposed to biologics before they get on this drug. The UNIFY trials were ustekinumab in ulcerative colitis. And you can see here they also looked at the induction arms of either 130 milligrams or 6 mg per kg. And then you can see the standard results there looking at remission, clinical response, and endoscopic healing. In our studies of induction, we've looked at standard outcomes after those infusions, and we have used the 6 milligram per kilogram dosing. And in maintenance, we've adopted, as I said, the 90 every 8. I want to highlight for you what was unique about UNIFY and things that moved our field forward, as Janssen has nicely done when they developed this particular program, is we had for the first time an endpoint of a combined endoscopic and histologic healing. Now, why is that relevant? Well, it was actually the FDA that suggested if you wanted to use the term mucosal healing, it wasn't sufficient to show endoscopic improvement. That was just what you saw with the scope. And true to form, to understand what's happening at the level of the mucosa, we acknowledge there's some role of understanding what the histology looks like. Now, whether that's actually the right endpoint for treating, we haven't completely understood yet, but I would suggest to you that it probably is in some ways. I also want to highlight for you the results that you're seeing here, which is how fast ustekinumab works. And the important thing to understand that is so you can tell patients. If I give you this drug, it's likely if you're going to do well, you're going to notice within the first 1 or 2 weeks that you're immediately feeling better. I think that's a really important message, and to riff on what I said this morning about small molecules, it suggests you can avoid steroids. And so here are the histoendoscopic mucosal healing data. I want to highlight again for you that the every 8 weeks seems to be a better interval for your maintenance. That's why we use it. And you may have patients who ask you to go at every 12. You should know what psoriasis is every 12, but at a lower dose, 45 milligrams. And in general, I haven't supported that for most of my patients. Nonetheless, you can see what histoendoscopic healing looks like, but more importantly, you can see some clinical outcomes from it. The patients who achieve that level of healing, endoscopic improvement plus a histological control, were more likely to continue doing well than if they had achieved either one of those endpoints alone. So we've all had patients where it looks okay on scope, but the biopsies show activity you didn't appreciate. And we certainly have patients who look inflamed on scope. We call it some level, but the histology is less. That's very well described. So importantly here, if you have both of those, the endoscopic improvement, which is a Mayo score of 0 or 1 with histology improvement, those patients do much better. So ustekinumab educated us. The mechanism works in Crohn's and UC. We have a novel endpoint in ulcerative colitis that has really set the stage and standard for all of our other UC trials going forward. And we certainly learned a lot about safety and this concept of IV induction and subcutaneous maintenance. So there was much that did to advance our field. It made sense, though, to start thinking about could we be more selective and what could we do with P19s. We, of course, are following what the dermatologist showed us, which is that they developed P19s to treat psoriasis before we had them, and they demonstrated superior efficacy, and they were very happy with how that therapy looked. The first P19 inhibitor to make it to the U.S. market is risankizumab, which was developed for Crohn's disease, and I'll show you some of the data in development for ulcerative colitis. You can see similarly an IV induction phase, in this case three doses that are IV, and then a subcutaneous maintenance phase. And I won't get into all the details here except to say similar concepts here. Conventional or biofailure patients versus those who are all biofailure. And in general, unlike what we'd seen in many other trials, even when you had been exposed to one anti-TNF therapy, but even two anti-TNF therapies, this mechanism worked really well. And understanding the immunology of it would be of interest to all of us, but certainly understanding it from a clinical point of view and knowing that this is an excellent therapy to be considered second line after anti-TNF, let alone first line, makes good sense. So these data led to its approval and its availability in Crohn's, and we've been happy with it so far. I also want to highlight for you some ongoing maintenance data, which led to the maintenance dosing for this drug in our Crohn's patients and clearly shows very nicely. And just to give you the orient you on the slide, it's clinical remission and endoscopic response. And I want to just point out to you that for a long time, we thought that endoscopic response and even endoscopic remission in Crohn's wasn't possible, that it was something that we would like to see, but we didn't know how to get there. But with our novel therapies, we're starting to see that, and that includes risankizumab very nicely.
David, do you want to make a comment on that slide? One of the other issues that we've come up against as clinicians is the dosing of these medications, trying to get approval for shortening the interval of, say, infliximab, sure. Shortening whatever. If I'm understanding this on the extreme left is essentially they got one dose in induction and no more. And
that, now right, those are the patients who got randomized to placebo in maintenance.
Right.
I think it's worth mentioning that. And sometimes people say, well, what happened to them in maintenance then? How long did the drug carry over? The other thing we often talk about is a placebo response that's carrying over. And that's of interest to know as well. You don't see the placebo called out separately here. But I do want to highlight for you that the patients there that you see, 41% clinical remission, this is in maintenance after only getting the IV loading doses. So they're not on maintenance dosing. All the way out to a year, you have 41% of patients who are still in clinical remission. I think that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's not as good as the patients who got drug in maintenance, but it's not horrible. And it leads you to ask, number one, what's the durability of the therapy? And secondly, what should we think about in terms of who are those patients and who does well as we follow them out? If you look at the subset analyses in these cases, it ends up being people who had early response, like they do well with the drug, that mechanism right away. We know those patients. And it also ends up being the people who achieve endoscopic control so that they're likely to achieve a deeper level of remission. So when you get into maintenance phase and you're giving them placebo, they seem to be stable over time. Did you want to make another point about that?
No, I mean, I guess I agree completely. It also means that at least we're getting closer, hopefully, to having doses that are the right doses for these medications.
Oh, right. So your comment, though, about dose escalation, I didn't want to say that. In the earliest days of ustekinumab, and you'll comment further on this, Jessica, we had our first 500 patients with Crohn's who we gave usta at the University of Chicago. One out of five, 20% of them, were those who we either needed or we tried to get dose escalation for. And that was a larger number than perhaps we would have anticipated, but it's not uncommon. We all take care of patients with IBD and see that they seem to need dose escalation. And to your point earlier, Maria, and to Jessica's work as well, we did not see dose escalation work in people who were primary non-responders. No. It was the people who were responders but not remitters, or the people who remitted but then lost response, where dose escalation worked. That's all with ustekinumab. With risankizumab in Crohn's, we've only tried to give dose escalation to a small number. We haven't gotten insurance approval for many of them, and I'm not sure if it's at the same rate as what we saw with usta, but I think it's early for us to know that in the real world. I don't know, Jessica, what do you think?
We've done something similar. So, and I'll go through this a little bit more during my section, but similarly, we have found that in the patients who are primary non-responders, really there's very little utility in dose escalation in the ustekinumab population. But there is a good percentage of patients, about 50% actually, who will recapture with dose escalation if they've had a partial response or secondary loss of response. I'm curious, though, as we're presenting, we're talking about doses. Do either of you ever use the 180 dose, or are you exclusively using the 360?
I'm only using 360.
Right. Only using the 360.
Similar.
I think with the safety, and even if it's only a numerical edge, and also maybe because we're in a referral-based sort of biased practice, I stick with the higher doses otherwise. Right. But I'm sure others in the room may have some experience differently, and you'll teach us about that too. Risankizumab is being studied in ulcerative colitis. These are phase 3 data that have been presented. And just to orient you to these results, this is a stacked bar, where you have the clinical response in light blue and clinical remission in dark blue at 12 weeks after induction phase. That's similar to what we do with Crohn's. And you can appreciate that the therapy clearly works in this disease state. And, of course, we're expecting it to move forward. Now let's move on to a different P19 inhibitor. This is mirikizumab, which is now available in the U.S. for ulcerative colitis, moderate to severe UC. And similarly, we have an IV induction phase and then subcutaneous maintenance phasing. Here's the week 12 induction data looking at clinical remission, stacked bar again, green is clinical response, blue clinical remission, and then the randomized responders went into the maintenance phase and showing you the primary and secondary outcomes of interest with mirikizumab. You've also seen that Lilly, who developed mirikizumab, invested in understanding and studying rectal and bowel urgency as one of the things they were interested in, and I certainly support as a very important symptom amongst our patients. There's nothing specifically unique to mirikizumab that treats urgency, but I certainly appreciate the value of studying it so we can include it and think about it in all the other therapies we use and always ask patients about it. And we did include it in the ulcerative colitis guidelines from the ACG in 2019, and it is being included in the next version of those that we're finishing now. Now, also, mirikizumab is being studied in Crohn's. Not surprisingly, why wouldn't they? So these are the results of the phase 3 study called Serenity, looking at mirikizumab, and you can see week 12 results here. If you're keeping score, you'll note that these results are similar to risankizumab. Again, not head-to-head, but nonetheless, you can appreciate it. And you can see dose ranging here, which interestingly suggested that the 600 milligram dose, the middle dose, was better with mirikizumab, and we'll see how that proceeds and which dose is going to ultimately be the winner, and I think 600 will probably be it. Janssen has their own P19 inhibitor. This drug has been on the market and for psoriasis already and has been studied in both UC and Crohn's. It's called guselkumab, and you can see here the similar design, IV loading induction phase, and then the maintenance of injection, which I'll show you in a second. Excuse me. I've been talking all day.
I'll drink some water. I want to say to you, some people have said that they like the video. Yes, everything is going to be available online, so you could use it for...
They're saying that while I'm presenting?
Whatever. Yeah. Whatever.
Go back to the video.
The video of the little, like, yeah, the little the animated graphics.
See, AI is going to replace all of us.
That's right. The other question, actually, David, that before you get into Gus more deeply. If a person doesn't respond, if a patient doesn't respond within the first week after they get used to ustekinumab, do you change course? I mean, I suppose it's a broader question of when do you get out of Dodge? And we could say it broadly, I think, for this class. When do you get out of Dodge?
Well, in the original ustekinumab trial, it was designed that if you didn't respond to the IV induction at that primary induction endpoint, you were eligible to get a second IV dose. And there were some patients who were captured that way, and so there seemed to be a benefit. Right. We're going to talk about the POWER study, which explored that for patients who were responders and lost response. So there's a difference between primary non-responders, where giving them a second dose might have value, and whether we can get it, first of all, and people who are loss of response, and that's what Jessica, I think, will teach us more about, where it doesn't seem to have as much value, if I can say the punchline. Getting back to Gus, you can see the induction data, and you see here, again, we have two different doses compared with placebo, and you can see that the doses look similar, but what's of great interest is how the maintenance study was designed, where there were some options to consider here and think about in terms of how patients would follow up. And you can appreciate the complexity of this, but looking at what IV dose followed by what injection dose for maintenance would be the best combination. And it looks like the 600 to 200 is the winner here in doing well. And those are quite impressive response and remission rates out to week 48, a very effective therapy in Crohn's. And we're going to hear the potential immunologic and molecular explanation for that particular very nice observation. And, of course, Gus is also being studied in ulcerative colitis, and we'll be talking lots more about that as well.
Yeah. David, I have another question for you. How do you define endoscopic response? And I actually think in this context, I'd like to say not necessarily, you know, there's always that technical definition in each study. You have to read the fine print of how they defined endoscopic response. But what do you say to your colleagues, your GI colleagues, in terms of what should they be looking for? How should they be evaluating the you know, by colonoscopy to make that decision?
Well, I'll start by saying that endoscopic response is only part of how I assess patients who are responding to therapy in Crohn's. And I prefer looking at serum CRP. I prefer looking at, of course, the patient-reported outcomes. And then when I do endoscopic assessments, I am certainly looking for either complete healing of the bowel, which is possible and happens, or at least substantial improvement of the ulcers. And, of course, as you're experienced, and there's many in this room who are, you can appreciate when an ulcer is healing versus one that hasn't changed at all. You also probably have pretty good pretest probability of those ulcers that seem like they're not going to heal when you see those deep, furrowing, sort of bear claw types of ulcerations. But I've seen those heal, too.
Right.
I would add to this that there's a role for intestinal ultrasound that may redefine what this means. And in the ustekinumab experience, looking at a study we're going to talk about called Stardust, and you'll hear more about it, there was an intestinal ultrasound arm. But from the standpoint of as clinicians, it's enabling us to look much sooner than we used to. So we used to say, well, let's do a colonoscopy at 6 months and see how you're doing. Now we're starting to say, let's look at 4 weeks or 6 weeks and get a sense of how your transmural inflammation is improving. And so not only, I've been emphasizing this to the ultrasound community, not only does that enable earlier time to make treatment decisions, it also gives us new insight into pathogenesis and bowel healing in ways we never appreciated or could even measure. So I think that that's a whole other conversation, but I think it's very important.
Right.
And I usually, whatever I'm doing, I usually plan 6 weeks after I start a therapy to do something objective to reassess.
That's really great. All right, so so far David has told you about, obviously this mechanism is effective. We're going to have, you know, we already have multiple choices, and we have some already in the pipeline that are, I'm sure, going to get approval for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. So then it begs the question, how are we going to differentiate between these different IL-23 targeting agents? So I'm going to ask you a question. I know you're all overachievers. You should not know the answer to this question.
But you could.
But you could. You might. If you do, great. If you don't, my hope is that by the next time you see this question, hint, 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 that you'll know the answer. So I want to tell you a little bit about Fc gamma receptors, and I'll try to make this as painless as possible so that no one is asleep in the next few minutes. You know, imagine that you have antibodies, that now, you know, the immune system has made antibodies and coating a bacteria, right? So now they're coating a bacteria. How does that get rid of a bacterium, right? Because that's, again, the immune system is all designed around trying to get rid of pathogens and protecting us. Well, there are these receptors, Fc gamma, you know, gamma as in like the gamma chain of an IgG molecule, that can bind to these receptors on these are receptors on the surface of professional eating cells, phagocytic cells like macrophages and dendritic cells, so that they can say, kind of stick to the bacterium that's coated with immunoglobulin, so they can eat it and get rid of it, so we can get rid of the infection. So that's the purpose of it in biology. But let me talk to, but then biology wasn't assuming that we're going to be giving monoclonal antibodies against cytokines, right, to treat a disease, or monoclonal antibodies against anything to treat a disease. So it turns out that Fc gamma receptor 1, otherwise known as CD64, because, of course, immunologists always have two names for everything, right, cluster of differentiation CD64, are expressed on monocytes and macrophages. This is true in the gut. It's also true in other, you know, if this was a derm talk, we'd say that it's in skin. If this was a talk on arthritis, we'd say that this is in joints. So these Fc gamma receptors bind to immunoglobulins, and in particular to IgG1. And it turns out that, you know, again, fun fact, many of the biologics that we use are IgG1, right? So that means that in the native state, Fc gamma receptors should be binding to our normal, any monoclonal antibody that any company would make that is IgG1. Okay? That's the background. But the other thing you should know is that often companies purposefully mutate so that the IgG, the synthetic IgG that they've made, cannot bind to Fc gamma receptors. On purpose they do that, so that there's that takes that out of the equation, that these cells are involved. It just allows the monoclonal antibody to do one thing, which is only to bind the target. In this case, we're going to talk about IL-23. So it turns out, again, as a background for what I'm about to show you, that risankizumab, they chose to mutate, like most biologics, this region that would allow it to bind to Fc gamma receptors, whereas guselkumab is the native IgG1, like as if the body had made it naturally, and therefore it can bind to Fc gamma receptors. And we're about to see what that actually translates into, or potentially translates into, at the level of what's happening in the mucosa. So here is an immunoglobulin. We'll call this IgG1, right? That means that, if taking you back to medical school, that the heavy chain is a gamma receptor of immunoglobulin. And so this is the native. This would be the example of, say, guselkumab, whereas in the case of risankizumab, it purposely had a genetic engineering so that this Fc gamma could not bind to Fc gamma receptors. I'm not going to show you the data, but both of these antibodies, and I'm assuming mirikizumab too, by the way, are extremely good at binding interleukin-23. As you know, it binds the P19 unit, right, because we know it's different than ustekinumab, but they're very effective. Equally effective at binding IL-23 molecules in solution. Okay, so there's that. Now remember, we're back to this inflammatory myeloid cell that's busy making interleukin-23, activating these Th17 molecules, right? So this cell is making IL-23, turning on and upsetting these Th17 cells that are going to go on to develop, you know, cause bad IBD. In the case of something like risankizumab that has this mutated, you know, gamma chain of IgG1, it cannot bind the surface of that monocyte that's expressing Fc gamma receptors. Okay, so all the binding of interleukin-23 is happening in solution. Is happening in solution, but not on the surface of the cell. So here's the cell making it. It's binding in the solution, not sort of targeted to the cell that's making it. By contrast here, if you have a normal IgG1, in this case it's guselkumab, it can bind the Fc gamma receptors on the surface of the actual cell that is busy making interleukin-23. And there's biological evidence, experimental evidence, I should say, that in point of fact, this is happening, that you can stimulate a cell, it will make interleukin 23, and guselkumab bound to the cell itself is busy capturing the generated interleukin 23. So this is actually something we can show, I say we, the royal we, not me, can show experimentally is happening in the case of guselkumab that happens not to occur with risankizumab. Again, I'll make the point that in solution, they're both binding beautifully interleukin 23. Okay, so with that as a backdrop.
So does the implication is that it may be clinically more effective, clinically more durable. What do you think this will translate into?
Yeah, that in a sense that now you're getting this extra bang for your buck because now this interleukin 23 that's being secreted by the cell can't go very far because it's going to be, some of it is going to be captured. What proportion is captured locally versus makes it out into its nearby environment to then come in contact with the antibody, that remains to be seen. But it may, what would be curious is, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm not busy looking at the dosing of these medications, right? Some of the doses are very different in terms of milligrams, and presumably these are all this, about the same molecular weight, right? Immunoglobulins, whether they're, you know, they should be about the same molecular weight. And so maybe it represents that. I certainly think that these drugs are safe, so it's not an issue of safety one way or another. But I think it's a curious thing that this occurs. The other curious thing is that this mechanism of action, it highlights how, you know, there are all these little subtle differences between these medications that we use, and only over time do we appreciate, like, why there might be differences in efficacy. But, you know, to your point, David, we'll see if that changes the equation of rapidity or of efficacy or of durability of response.
So my follow-on question is just, if you were going to measure a serum concentration of guselkumab, is it going to reflect adequately what we need to see? Or is there a much greater percentage of the antibody that's actually bound to cells that we're not going to even appreciate that we used to not know about?
Right. I just reviewed a paper that has to do with anti-TNFs and actually harkens back to the work that that Andres Yarr did when he was at the University of Miami that looked at tissue concentrations of infliximab. And to cut to the chase...
And TNF.
They also measured TNF. I don't want to say too much about the paper. I don't remember who wrote it and if you could possibly be here in the audience. But
I thought you wrote it with Andres.
No. This paper I just reviewed.
Oh.
I just reviewed a paper for the IBD Journal.
I don't know that.
And
paper. I was talking about your paper.
Yeah, I know you're talking about our paper. But they found very similar things to our paper. But what was nice about their paper is that in their paper, what they found was that the tissue levels of the anti-TNF did a better job of predicting the long term, whether they were going to respond for a longer period of time. So the tip of the iceberg is what we're measuring in serum. It's just, you know, measuring in tissue, of course, is always going to be more cumbersome, but probably is going to be very edifying. And back to what David is asking me, one wonders if with this mechanism, will this allow there to be greater local concentrations of this antibody? That's all speculative, by the way. What I'm saying is all speculative. Because, again, maybe you're going to see this question again. Guselkumab can bind the CD64, whereas, you know, risankizumab can't. All right. Guess what? We have the question again. Who knew?
Not me.
No, we had no idea. All right, so now you get a second chance.
Look at that.
Gosh.
Good job.
Great job.
This is stressful. This is stressful.
So
thank you.
Before I move on into the next section, we've got a couple of questions from the audience here. So for patients that have either lost or had partial response to ustekinumab, would you consider using an IL-23 in those patients, or do you feel like they've then failed the mechanism and you should move on?
Well, in the risankizumab Crohn's study, they allowed patients to have been exposed to ustekinumab. Those data have been presented. And it worked. 50% of the patients who had prior USTA experience had a response to risankizumab. And in our own experience at U of C, we've described that and published it as well. It was almost 75%. So I think the answer to that is yes. I would ask the opposite, which is if you start with a P19, is there value to going to a P40, to ustekinumab second? And we don't have the data on that. As usual, we're sort of going linearly. But we need to think about that because I think there may be value to understanding that. I have a colleague who believes it is true, but we need to prove it.
And then along those lines, Maria, is there a ideal patient, either Crohn's or UC, where you feel like this is really the agent you should be using first line, this mechanism?
That's a great question. You know, in the early days of ustekinumab, I used to think, well, in that rare exception where someone has granulomatous Crohn's disease, maybe they'll respond better, right? And that turned out not to be the case, not to be the case. I think what we're learning is that ileal Crohn's disease behaves very differently than colonic Crohn's disease. It certainly responds slower to therapy, and the gene expression at every level, even when in isolated lymphocytes or in isolated monocytes and macrophages from ileum compared to colon, they're different. But at least in subgroup analysis, everybody seems, if they're going to respond, they respond, right? The ileum takes longer to improve, right? When people have spent the time to look at endoscopy results, I'm not sure that this has been studied as carefully with this, but in that same study that David was alluding to that looks at endoscopic intestinal ultrasound in people who are on ustekinumab, again, the ileum was slower to respond compared to the colon, always responds faster. So I'm not sure I have an answer. I'd love to know that answer, actually. I think we're going to put a little bit of energy into that. I think it's worth putting energy into it now that we have this new generation of version 2.0 and have these IL-23 inhibitors, which are clearly very effective, so that we can really understand, since it's a more, in my mind, black and white signal with these IL-23 inhibitors, can we find a phenotype? But a priori, I think we'll get to it, like how we would position this. But this seems to work well and is very safe. And I often am erring on the side of starting with this therapy. I'd prefer to start with this therapy than anti-TNF generally. Go for it.
All right. So we've really set this section up quite nicely. So thank you to my co-presenters. So really, we've talked a lot about the efficacy of these agents. But what happens if you start to lose response? How can you really optimize this mechanism? And then how do we think about rational combination therapy? So we're going to go through some of the data that has helped start to sort this out. So we've mentioned the POWER study. But what the POWER study was is really looking at patients with moderate to severe Crohn's disease who had already been initiated on ustekinumab. They had already undergone IV induction and were already in the maintenance phase and had experienced a secondary loss of response. So these are patients who had initially done well and are now losing response. And at that time, they enter into the study and are randomized either to an IV reinduction, so they get another IV loading dose, or they're basically continued on this standard sub-Q maintenance. So none of these patients were on Q4 or Q6-week dosing, only Q8-week standard dosing, which I think is important to note. And I think you might think, well, why do this study? I think there was a lot of initial question around, would IV reloading actually be better than just increasing the sub-Q dose to Q4, Q6, which one had been quite hard to get from an insurance standpoint, and two is very expensive. So if we could potentially recapture these patients with an IV reload, could we keep them then on the standard 8-week dose? So I think that's sort of a little bit of the background going into this study, and you can see here the time points at which patients were assessed, and the primary endpoint was really looking at a clinical response at week 16. And I know we sort of mentioned this already, but the spoiler alert was that unfortunately this study did not ultimately meet its primary endpoint. As you can see here, among all comers into the study, there wasn't a statistically significant difference of clinical response at week 16, although you can appreciate that there is a numerical difference of the proportion of patients who did achieve a clinical response at week 16 in the IV reload group compared to the sub-Q maintenance group. And that holds true for patients who are bio-naive, although the numbers of the bio-naive patients in the study are pretty small. Those who had experienced one prior biologic and two, but you see that starts to fall off once the patients are very exposed, three or more. And then when we look at the endoscopic remission rates here at week 16 as well, you see basically a marginal, a p-value of 0.04 among all the patients who had experienced this outcome with the IV reload compared to those in the sub-Q maintenance, but we don't see those signals across, the different individual subtypes significantly so for the most part. So I think, again, ultimately this study did not meet its primary endpoint, but if you start to look at some of the subgroup analyses that were done in the study, you ask yourself, well, should we be doing this in some patients? Is this a rational strategy? And I think a lot of it ultimately in clinical practice depends on where you practice. In my region, I find getting IV reloads almost impossible. I don't know if you guys have anything different, but I actually have an easier time escalating the sub-Q maintenance. And so that was one of the reasons why we chose to study this a bit more in depth. And so as we've been sort of discussing throughout the study, at our group, we did look at what happened to patients who had lost response to ustekinumab and then were escalated to either Q4 or Q6 week dosing. And we found that about 50% of patients did recapture with that maintenance dose escalation. And now we're actually in a prospective way studying, is there a difference between Q4 and Q6? Because I think we don't really know the difference between those two dosing strategies. Are you guys doing more IV reloads in practice, or you tend to just shorten your dosing interval?
I haven't. I have a couple questions for you, though.
Please.
My first question is, when you look at something like this, which is a pretty hard objective endpoint,
yeah,
endoscopic remission,
yeah,
there's clearly benefit here.
Yeah.
And so which patient, give us a phenotype of somebody in whom you would really do this if cost wasn't an issue. And then I'm going to ask my next question, which is maybe instead of IV,
yeah,
what about giving two injections, giving a double sub-Q dose? And is that going to be similar in pharmacokinetics, and would you consider it? My third is, does this do the same in UC, or do you think it's all Crohn's?
Those are all great questions. And so I do think ultimately when you see this study, yes, it ultimately didn't meet its primary endpoint, but I agree there is some interest here, and there clearly are some patients who will derive benefit from this method, of recapture. And so I think, to me, again, for those who have had a primary non-response, I don't find that sort of going through these great lengths to try to recapture has been very helpful or successful in my own practice and in what's been published. So I think that the patient who has had a secondary loss of response, I do think there is utility in either, in doing an IV reload, and honestly, and sometimes I'll then also potentially shorten the interval of maintenance depending on what we've found. And I think to your point, endoscopic remission is a hard endpoint. If you had seen endoscopic response, the patient was starting to feel better, you probably wouldn't give up on that therapy. Also, depending on where they were in their treatment cycle, is this a patient who's already failed multiple things and you're actually starting to derive some benefit? You're not going to give up so easily in that patient population. And so to ultimately answer your question, yes, I would be doing this in a number of patients. But we have had a few instances, to your question around the sub-Q, where we couldn't get this approved, and we actually worked really closely with our pharmacy team to actually mimic the IV load with sub-Q, and actually were able to do that instead, and actually had good success with that as well. So I do think there is some utility in the, sort of updosing the sub-Q, giving a bit more that way, and actually doing the same thing you would be with the IV reload. Or have you done something similar?
I have.
Since you asked the question, assuming you did.
This wasn't a setup. I have done it in a few people. I don't know to say whether it's as effective as this would be. But to me, this is also reflecting the challenges we face in clinical trials, right?
Yeah.
Looking at an endpoint that gives you a negative result when you look at other things where there's clearly some value in some patients.
Yeah.
And it's so important to figure out who those people are. I think it needs to be said.
Absolutely.
My last question was about ulcerative colitis.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. It was so many questions.
I lost
them. So I do find, I think, and you actually just showed us quite nicely a lot of the clinical trial data. And I do think overall the data with IL-23s does look quite impressive and pretty good across the board with all the agents in Crohn's disease. It does seem to look, for whatever reason, I think slightly less impressive in ulcerative colitis, if you look at the absolute numbers. And so I think as we just have our first IL-23 on the market for ulcerative colitis, I think figuring out where that fits in the treatment paradigm, at least for me personally, I haven't quite figured that out yet where I'm using it. I think for Crohn's, though, the story seems to be quite clear. I think for ulcerative colitis, which patient population is going to derive the most benefit really is this first line or should be used more second or further? I still haven't really figured that out for myself.
And meanwhile, you know, in rheumatology, for example, they don't bother trying to squeeze more juice out of the lemon. They move on to the next drug in class. And now we have multiple agents, so that may be somewhat of a moot point.
Do you do anything different, Maria? I didn't want to leave you out of this.
No. I'm enjoying sitting here and just listening to you guys talk about this. I think so much, like, I don't know, it seems like sometimes all of a sudden it's easy to get ustekinumab approved for every 4 weeks, and sometimes it's absolutely impossible, and we're left to actually often getting a reload can be easier to get, you know, and I've often wanted for certain types of patients, like say Medicare, to just be able to give it IV all the time, because then we could actually give it to these patients. So there's stuff that is too depressing to talk about without sort of SSRIs
cue the music.
At the table.
Seriously.
At the table. So there's that dimension of the like we can speculate and talk and like all the stuff, because again, this is like kind of a short term fix. I can't help but think, okay, it's like maybe gets the party started, but ultimately these are patients that probably need to have more frequent dosing, and that's probably where why it didn't look even better, right?
And I think the reality is, in practice, if I am doing this, I'm probably doing both. I'm usually not doing one and just saying, I hope this works out. So let's talk about a potential different strategy to really try to optimize our patients. So this is the Stardust study, which we had heard alluded to, and this is really looking at, again, ustekinumab, but using a treat-to-target sort of methodology as opposed to more a standard of care strategy. And so if you're not familiar with the term treat-to-target, you know, this comes to us from the STRIDE guidance and really looking at sort of rational, objective targets that you're going to follow in patients. And if you're not hitting those targets, you're going to dose adjust to make sure that you're hitting those targets, as opposed to the sort of more standard of care strategy where you're doing it based solely on symptoms, right? The patient starts to not feel well, and so then you dose adjust in response to that. And so what this study looked at was patients who were receiving ustekinumab, again, with Crohn's disease. They went through induction and then a maintenance dose, and then at the week 16 mark, they were assessed, and those who had responded, so they were initial responders to ustekinumab, were essentially randomized to either this treat-to-target, more strict, you know, sort of follow-up strategy as opposed to standard of care. And patients were followed out quite far to really look at which arm did better. You know, if we're really following these patients quite closely, ultimately, will we have better outcomes? And the clinical targets that were assessed in this study were clinical, you know, CDAI scores, biomarker targets, so looking at CRP, looking at fecal calprotectin. As we heard, there was an ultrasound component to this as well. And so really, again, looking at objective markers as opposed to just how the patient was feeling clinically. And so when we look at the data, again, looking at clinical response, clinical remission, and some of that biomarker normalization, and this is looking out at week 48, ultimately there was this study looked at the standard of care arm, the treat-to-target arm, did not necessarily do better than the standard of care arm. And when you look at the data across all of the different primary and secondary endpoints that were assessed. And so even just thinking about that, does that rationally make sense to you, David? I mean, when you saw the outcomes of this study, did you think that makes no sense to me?
Well, it gets back to symptom-based endpoints versus more objective measures, as well as the complexity of if we're just going to look at changing dosing intervals without considering the pharmacodynamics of the therapy or the targets we're trying to treat, we're missing big components and compartments of this equation.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the challenge. On the other hand, as a clinician, it's helpful to know, and you do need to make some decisions. It does drive us home, though, to the era we're now in, which is an era to think about disease modification and not just symptom management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just to, like, say a happy note, the rates of remission are really very high.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's
The happy note to me is the next slide, which the audience can't see yet, which is some of the more objective measures. So there is value to this. And it gets back to this question again, which is sort of a theme here at this whole meeting, certainly in the morning's wonderful keynote, is we need to have some better therapeutic biomarkers.
Absolutely. And so, again, to sort of wrap up Stardust, in this study, ultimately, as noted, there were no significant differences in the rate of endoscopic response between the two, but you can see this numeric difference, again, of the more objective markers. And personally, I do practice with a treat-to-target sort of methodology. In my practice, I think that we know that there is generally a poor correlation between clinical symptoms and objective markers, especially in Crohn's, although that is true in ulcerative colitis as well. And so I always say, like, when I ultimately do that scope, I don't want to be surprised. I want to know already what I'm going to find. So I like, following objective markers along the way so that you can really dose optimize or adjust as needed. So that is how I practice. But in this study, again, dose escalation rates were about 42% in the treat to target group. So again, patients were not hitting those outcomes. So we were making an adjustment compared to 30% in the standard of care arm. So it's not that nobody was getting dose optimized in the standard of care arm, just slightly less. And shortening of dose intervals, notably, of course, did lead to increase in the ustekinumab trough levels, but that did not significantly increase endoscopic or clinical response rates. Again, so thinking about TDM with these mechanisms, how do we think about trough levels? Are you guys doing TDM in this mechanism or looking at trough levels?
No.
No, but
for ustekinumab.
For ustekinumab.
I do. I think it's helpful if they're very low. I think it's occasionally helpful when it's almost zero, and then we can get approval for another IV load, as an example.
Yeah. Honestly, insurance is probably the biggest driver.
There is one payer, or at least one payer, who requires a ustekinumab level before they'll let you do anything.
Yeah. Same.
It's interesting how they cherry-pick data to decide such things.
Right.
And then after you ordered that level that they wanted you to get, they tell the patient it was experimental.
Incredible. So the last section that I'm going to be covering, and we, again, I think Maria set this up beautifully, is really thinking about combinations of therapies. You know, unfortunately, we still have a lot of room for improvement with regards to response rates and regard to which patients are responding to what drug. And until we have that holy grail test that tells us which mechanism patients are going to respond to, you know, a lot of what we're doing is trial and error, unfortunately. And so thinking about, especially some of these very refractory patients, should we be layering different mechanisms on to really be able to achieve some of those higher response rates that we ultimately hope for? And this could look, you know, several ways. Maybe you put them on at the same time. Maybe you're layering them. And so I think that there's certainly a lot of discovery now happening in this space and thinking about what combinations make sense, both from an efficacy standpoint, but also, of course, from a safety standpoint, I think is really important. And there's some investigation going on to this work. So, of course, we're here talking mostly about IL-23s. And so there is a lot of work going into looking at anti-IL-23s plus anti-TNF. And I think, as we heard earlier from Maria about this TNF resistance story, I think there is a biologic plausibility as to why this combination really does make sense. You know, are you potentially then really potentiating that anti-TNF to hopefully work better? I think David's question earlier about the sequencing of this, I think, is really interesting, and I'm down to do that study that we just proposed. So, but we have data from the VEGA study, which I will share with you in just a minute. And again, these are looking at combinations of anti-TNF and anti-IL-23s. The DUET programs are ongoing, so for both Crohn's and UC, and so hopefully we'll have some readout data from those not too long. They actually enrolled quite quickly. There are other mechanism combinations that are being looked at, so anti-integrin plus anti-TNF plus methotrexate is another sort of combination trial that is also ongoing. But here's the VEGA study, and so this looked at golimumab, guselkumab, or the combination, and this is in ulcerative colitis patients. And so this study had an induction phase that was the combination phase, which, again, patients were either on monotherapy with either of these agents or combination, and then they all moved into a monotherapy phase. Everyone in the guselkumab or combination arm went on to Gus. If you received golimumab initially, you stayed on golimumab in the monotherapy phase. And so here is the clinical endpoints. And as you can see here in the combination arm, we see pretty impressive both clinical response and remission rates, both at week 12. And then we see a slight drop off in response, but actually an increase in remission, you know, leading out. So potentially if you did well at induction, and again, these are patients who were dropped off the anti-TNF out at the week 38 endpoint. And we see in second place, essentially in this study, you see the guselkumab arm looking quite good as well. And so there does seem to be some real interest and rational explanation for why we might do combination, whether it be upfront just for induction or even further out in maintenance. And I think once we see the readouts from the DUET studies, we'll have a lot more information about this.
Great.
Yeah. This is really interesting. Actually, they, I hope I'm not revealing confidences, but they've been busy trying to understand molecularly what's happening. And what I find interesting is that the anti-TNF-treated patients have a lot of immunological effects systemically. That kind of makes sense, right? Because, you know, you give an anti-TNF and it's working on a lot of different things, whereas most of the effects of the IL-23 are locally happening in the gut. And so it'll be interesting to see can you peel off the other one? Do you really need both of them for a long time? Like, what is the ideal thing? So lots of questions. We'll turn it over to David to bring us home.
Yeah, so for the final few slides, it's just about what have we learned regarding superiority of one agent over another, and how can we interpret that in terms of clinical sequencing, which treatment to use first, or when we might consider something, at least from an efficacy point of view. But I will comment on safety. So we do have a head-to-head trial, the first one available in Crohn's disease, which was called SeaView, which compared ustekinumab to adalimumab. And I want to point out to you a couple things about this, which I thought was a strength and very interesting. Number one is that these were patients who were bio-naive. And as I mentioned earlier, bio-naive is usually a measure also of shorter disease duration, especially in moderate to severe Crohn's. And you can see the schema here in which patients were randomized to either ADA or ustekinumab at standard dosing, very well designed with placebo IV if you're getting adalimumab, and placebo injection if you're getting ustekinumab, and specifically looking out at the primary endpoint, which was clinical remission at week 52, as well as a number of secondary endpoints. The pretest hypothesis was that ustekinumab would be superior to adalimumab, but as you'll see here in the primary and major secondary endpoint, the two were equally effective. But to the point made earlier about a different study, I will highlight for you the quite nice remission rates out to a year. Look at this, 61% with adalimumab and 65% with ustekinumab. And I always tell people this is what you might expect if you use the right drug early in the disease course. You don't select out people who've already failed multiple therapies and throw them into a clinical trial. So as depressing as it has been for us in many ways to see very low remission rates in some of our phase 3 trials, look what you can get when you treat early. On the other hand, it didn't demonstrate ustekinumab being superior from an efficacy point of view. And when you look at other things like steroid-free remission, et cetera, there were similarities across the board. The one interesting thing is there were more dropouts in the adalimumab arm related to injection problems. So I would suggest that it's telling us about tolerability, and tolerability wasn't quite as good with ADA, and these were citrate-free adalimumab injections. The safety was similar. So as much as we've emphasized the local, what we think may be local effective IL-23 and anti-IL-23 and the safety of the therapy and all the trials in our world experience, we also see in a clinical trial like this that there was not much difference. And it also gets to what we've learned is that one of the major adverse events in clinical trials is disease worsening from ineffective therapy. You use effective therapies, you get less adverse events, things tend to even out. And I think it's an important message for patients. The second head-to-head trial we've had in Crohn's also involves ustekinumab. This is risankizumab compared with ustekinumab, head-to-head. But I want to highlight for you, in this trial, this is not bio-naive. These are people who were TNF-exposed. So they had already been on anti-TNF. So just to keep it clean, and I want to make sure you understand that if you have a patient who's already been on anti-TNF and now you're looking to go to an IL-23 therapy, this is trying to answer the question, is the P19 therapy risankizumab superior to the P40 therapy ustekinumab? And actually, unlike what you saw in SeaView in bio-naive patients against adalimumab, when you look at RISA versus USTA, the P19 here was superior to ustekinumab in the primary and all the ranked secondary endpoints. Actually did quite nicely here. And I want to highlight for you that this is of interest, but it also is across disease states. There are head-to-head trials that compare Riza to ustekinumab in plaque psoriasis. Same outcome, same benefit here demonstrated. And there are additional studies looking at Riza compared to adalimumab in plaque psoriasis, where Riza was superior to adalimumab. So I think we can learn from this. And then the question, of course, becomes, how would you position these therapies? Is this efficacy difference one that will make you consider this drug over Usta? Remember, though, this is in patients who were TNF exposed. So specifically that group of people. I would suggest to you that C-View informs us a little bit, but the real world and other evidence would suggest that in bio-naive patients, it might be a wash and there's likely to be equal benefit, and therefore you shouldn't be as worried about that in that scenario. Safety was similar, very safe agents. We know this mechanism offers that for our patients, which is why in combo studies, I think leaving the IL-23 on board is something that patients will like and makes sense from that point of view at least. So with that, dear moderator, I hand it back to you.
All right.
Wrap us, and okay, we can certainly spend some time answering questions.
We're bringing it home. All right. So hopefully, you know, we've left you with these SMART goals or things that we hope you've learned, which is that, you know, these that IL-23 is obviously a very important pathway, and that's going to be part of our armamentarium in treating these patients. We still are trying to figure out in our own minds how we optimize these therapies, how we pick the right types of patients, and hopefully, you know, I think there are a couple of questions in the queue about that. And then we're going to have a lot of, you know, a lot more choices in terms of these inhibitors in treating our patients with IBD. So I'm going to ask a couple of more. Actually, I was looking at my phone because one of the questions here was whether ustekinumab binds to CD64. So I found articles that there are lots of different ways that you can mutate antibodies so that they won't bind to CD64. And I couldn't find ustekinumab on that list, but I don't know the answer to that question in a quick Google search up here from the stage. So we'll have to get back to you on that. I think David mentioned that these drugs are safe, right? But there's one person who puts in here that this must be someone who's got a skewed patient population, that they've had 3 patients with common variable immunodeficiency where ustekinumab didn't look so safe. So I think it just acknowledges that people who have immunodeficiency syndromes, if you kick the chair out, you know, from their immune system in any way, you might really upset the apple cart. But for all intents and purposes, I think that I can't remember a patient that I thought, wow, this must be that ustekinumab is immunosuppressing them. And of course, I don't have enough experience yet with Riza to tell you otherwise. So I don't know if you
did. They tell you what their adverse events were?
Significant infection, sepsis. Have you seen infections in USTA treated patients on chemo? You know, I guess that's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, Jordan Axelrod and others have been interested in studying people who have cancer and they have IBD, and what do we know if we continue their biologic agents? And so I'm wondering, Jessica, what do you do? I mean, people, you know, the population is getting older that we're caring for. They're going to have cancer.
Yeah, so I think that a little bit depends on what type of cancer that they have and what they're going to be treated with, and also which biologic you're currently using. I think all of those variables do come into play. You know, liquid tumors, lymphomas. I think the need to get off of the current biologic agent may be higher. I've had a lot of patients, though, more recently. I shouldn't say a lot. Breast cancer, I think, is coming up quite a bit. And I've had several patients on anti-TNFs, then undergoing hormonal therapy for breast cancer. And I think we work really closely with the oncology team. And several of those patients, we actually didn't stop the anti-TNF, and they did quite well. I think this is actually coming up quite a bit, actually, with the JAK inhibitors as well. I've had a few patients either with a remote or recent history of a solid organ tumor, and there's been questions about what do we do with the JAKs? Is it safe in that population? And so I think that, for me, I think a lot depends on the cancer, what they're being treated with, and really how bad their IBD is, too, right? I mean, you really do have to manage both.
Have you used IL-23 inhibitors for immune checkpoint colitis? I have not.
I was going to say, I don't think I have. I really had to just rack my brain there.
I've used anti-TNF, yep, of course, and Vito, of course. Yeah. I've even used Vito prophylactically in anticipation of it in some higher risk patients. I just had my first patient who needed, and we put him on a JAK inhibitor for his immune colitis.
Oh, yeah.
And responded in 2 days.
Yeah.
Quite strong, impressive. But I did it in that case, with the oncologist, because these things are getting complex. And so talking about chemo, I agree completely. Yeah. You know, what is the treatment we're talking about?
That's right. What about, in what situation might you go directly to an IL-23 inhibitor? Let's talk about, are there examples in Crohn's disease? When are you going to an IL-23 inhibitor?
First line, you mean?
Let's do first line.
Yeah, so I think I feel like I always have Marla in my head a little bit about if the patient has earned an anti-TNF or not, how sick they are, how severe their disease is, what extraintestinal manifestations they may have. And so I think for a patient who has inflammatory disease, who doesn't have, you know, I think with psoriasis being the exception, you know, significant extraintestinal manifestations, and who hasn't really earned, you know, infliximab yet, I think IL-23 is my preferred first-line agent, actually, in Crohn's disease right now. One, given its safety profile, you know, very, very good efficacy rates. And again, two, thinking about what happens to patients post-anti-TNF, really trying to reserve that for later in the treatment course if I can. If they've got very severe disease, bad perianal disease, then still infliximab would be my first choice in that population.
The obvious one for me is someone who has coexistent plaque psoriasis, to use this as a first line, but I'll also give out the pearl if they have a history of atopic dermatitis or eczema, I'll use that as a clue. Now, it's nice to have that and say, I know exactly what drug I want to use for you because of this history. It doesn't always work that way, but it's where I would start for sure. Yeah. Whether you want to use IL-23 inhibitor as your first-line agent in general with Crohn's disease, absent perianal disease or penetrating complications, I think is an interesting and important question because you've got both the efficacy and safety there that looks quite nice, and it's often an easy narrative to tell a patient and to get them going on therapy, and I certainly have done that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Second line, this is my preferred treatment after TNF, and certainly post-op, I'm keen on this in that scenario for some patients.
I think the other aspect that we know less about right now is the durability, right? Because I started by mentioning that patients are kind of on an emotional roller coaster, that they're going to lose efficacy of a drug. And my sense, and sort of the interpretation from some of the longer-term ustekinumab studies, is that this mechanism seems to have longevity once people do respond to that. We'll begin to see whether that's also true with the IL-23 inhibitors. You know, these are all one-year studies.
Well, we saw that experimentally in the randomized responders who get placebo, right? You look out at week 48 or 52, and although that's a somewhat artificial denominator, you do see that some patients, that carries through for them off therapy.
Right.
Not that I encourage that.
But now we're thinking about in 4 and 5 years. And what about an ulcerative colitis? Is there an IL-23 first line, or should I ask you, what in general, your first line biologic?
Yeah, I think that where to position this mechanism, you know, in ulcerative colitis, I think for myself, I'm still sorting out a bit. I think, again, concurrent plaque psoriasis and things that sort of make it obvious to use this mechanism. But I think for me, you know, vedolizumab still remains the first line agent that I'm using in ulcerative colitis. I think when you look at the data, though, and the excellent safety profile, you could argue that these would be very reasonable first line agents. I think that the safety story and sort of you know, like the grassroots movement around Vito and how patients really, you know, I think that is hard to unseat. And so I think for me, that still remains my first line. But I do think that these agents, again, for me, I sort of delineate, have you earned infliximab because you have very severe pancolitis, you've been hospitalized, et cetera. So if you haven't, then I think vedolizumab or an anti-IL-23, you know, I think are very reasonable first-line choices.
I'm using more S1Ps as first-line.
You are?
In the moderate population, to be fair. And we all know who those are when you see their scopes and know what they're doing. And then I jump to Vito, and I think that it works after S1P, so I'm comfortable with that currently. I think ustekinumab still has a role in ulcerative colitis, and as much as we have good data for mirikizumab, I don't have real-world experience with that yet. Additional resources, you can check out the QR code as you walk to the next.
And if you want those videos, those little videos, if you want to be cool with your GI fellows or whoever you're trying to impress. on a first date. All right, guys, thank you so much for being a great audience.